This is the Risk Host Podcast.
We're doing something Russ Thomas composed.
It is 60s, 70s porno music.
Yeah.
Dude.
Like, wow, wow.
Awesome. All right, you ready? So I'm Alex Hutton, and with me today, as always, I have Jay Jacobs.
Hey, Alex.
I also have the ineffable Chris Hayes.
Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for that great introduction. By the way, you sound dreamy today.
Thanks. I am dreamy today.
Did you get a new microphone or something? I don't hear chafing.
No, I shaved.
Okay. All right.
And I want to welcome a special guest, a very special guest, a personal friend, a co-blogger, someone I hold in the highest esteem, Mr. Adam Shostak.
Hey, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, Adam. And Adam apparently is broadcasting out of his toilet.
Really? I sound that good?
You sound awesome.
Cool.
I'm waiting for the flush. Just kidding. All right, we can cut that out.
No, we can't. Go ahead.
So thanks for joining us, everybody. I appreciate it. We thought we'd start out today with a little thing we called Story Time with Jay Jacobs.
Yeah, so I've got a story here, and we'll see where it goes. But I was at work probably about 2 weeks ago now. It was a Tuesday, which is relevant to the story. And I had someone drop by my desk and say that they've heard that I do risky stuff. I know risk, and that they need some help with some risk, doing a risk analysis. And so first, the person introduces himself, and he's a project manager. Now, I'm not going to talk about the internals of my work, but he's a project manager, and he needs help with risk analysis. And so he goes into a story about he's been assigned by a director to go in and take a look at the, you know, enforce least user access in the specific group of people. It's a several hundred people. And so he has to go in, and he wants to do a risk analysis of people's access, and he's been working on it for a couple of weeks. And so he's like, what do I do? I'm sitting there and I'm trying to think of like what to tell this person. So, and he said, you know, I can identify the really easy ones that I want to fix, the really obvious, and some of the really not so obvious, I can kind of pick out the bottom, but there's a big gray area in the middle that I need to do risk analysis on. The first thing I said to him is I said, this is not a problem of risk. This is a problem with compliance. And he was like, no, there's, you know, a few fraction of these servers and this data is under compliance, so this really isn't a compliance thing. I'm like, nope, it's all compliance. You were told to do something, and you're supposed to comply. So it's a compliance problem. And so he's like, well, I guess so. And and then I said, and here's what you do. If you have to have this done by Friday, and I really have no bandwidth to help the guy, so having him sit down with me or me going through stuff, not an option. So I said, pick out some factors that seem important. Just pick them out of thin air, put them on a spreadsheet, and then go through each thing that you think of and rate them 1 through 5 or 1 through 3. You could even label them high, medium, low, and then add them up, and then you'll get a risk score. And in my and I go, now this is probably one of the worst things that you can do, but this is by far great to get something easy you can do by Friday.
Wow.
And then to really kind of seal the deal, the best part about this whole thing, I said, and also on that spreadsheet, when you're going to present it to people or what you did, on the bottom, go ahead and write down, based on NIST SP 800-30. Go ahead and just put that on there.
he actually did this, Alex, because he actually called me to confess. He called me in an afternoon to confess to this.
And did you tell him he could put a Powered by COVID sticker on it too?
No. And I said, so he's writing down NIST SP 800-30. I'm like, you could also say ISO 31000. And he's like, ISO 3100. I'm like, not 3100, 31000. Get that on the spreadsheet, and then it looks really, really good. And then he goes, do you have a template?
Oh my gosh.
So, I'm like, no, I don't.
So, like, do you remember years ago when the Rice Boys would tune up their Civics and stuff and drag race them and things? You just tuned this kid's spreadsheet. Dude, put an ISO sticker on it.
That'll make it go faster.
If I put this ginormous wing on the back of my Saturn, right. When I take it 150 through the S-curve, it's going to stick to the road.
So that was my story. I just, you know, funny thing. I didn't know what to tell the guy, and so I thought about it and came up with that. But
hey, and if anybody's really interested in project management, I've been reading the Herding Cats blog forever. That guy actually gets it pretty well in terms of project management and risk and kind of understanding risk and wanting to do a good job. And I'll just put that plug out there because it's a favorite of mine.
Yeah, good. Do you have a what URL off the top of your head?
I think you can just use this magic thing called Google and put in Herding Cats project management blog, and I'll get you there.
That's the Hayes approach, by the way, Jay.
Yeah.
Alex made fun of me the last time I said just Google it. Back at you, Alex.
Thanks, sweetheart.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's jump on to the next one and why Adam is here. Now, I got an email probably about a week ago saying that Adam wanted to come on the show, and it was something because of something I said. And so immediately I had this panic moment of like, what dumb, stupid thing did I say now that I'm going to get called out for? And so I went back and listened to the reference, and it wasn't actually that dumb. So I'm kind of hopeful that I'm not going to, you know, get schooled here. But Adam, did you want to tee up sort of your thinking and thought process coming on?
Sure, but with a teeing up like that, I gotta say you're gonna get new schooled here. But it'll be pleasant. It'll be fun.
Okay, good.
So what really jumped out at me was you were talking about feedback loops, and you were talking about how hard feedback loops are.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually, I'm gonna plug an article that Jay just sent me this morning because it's really good, and he wrote it, so he's gonna be embarrassed to plug it. So I'll start by plugging it. It's titled Call to Arms, It's Time to Learn Like Experts, and it's good stuff. I just read it in the last few minutes.
Can I ask something else here? Hey, Alex, Chris, have you guys read that?
Yeah, I did.
Really?
Your article, Jay?
Yeah.
I actually read it.
Wow.
I finished it up last night at around 11:45 p.m.
That is fantastic.
Dude, it took me two nights to get through it because it was very academic wonkish-like. But
and
I
all the math. It's killer math in there.
But I did read it, yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. I just wanted to be sure.
Yep, I'm committed to our relationship.
So what I actually wanted to talk to Jay and all of you about is some work that I've done lately. And this is work that I've done at work. Those of you who don't know me, I work at Microsoft in our Trustworthy Computing Group. And I've lately been really interested in the question of how computers are compromised and focusing in on how malware gets onto machines. And so as part of our Security Intelligence Report, Volume 11, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes, we had a featured article that talks about some work that I and other people had done. And one of the elements of this is what I actually wanted to sort of call to Jay's attention and also call to the attention of the readership, because I think it actually helps us build those feedback loops in a way that's easier than we've had before. And the work comes out of this project. I apologize for being long-winded here. I'm just trying to tee up the context. The project is called Broad Street, and so we're calling it the Broad Street Taxonomy. And if readers want to take a look at this, we'll have links in the show note. But the idea is that we have this systematic way of classifying instances of compromise, so that we can say, you know, the thing that went from okay, the instant that things went from okay to not okay, and the attacker got control of the system, it happened like this.
Specifically focused on malware, right?
Well, it started out that way. Okay. And actually, I'm going to thank Alex, because Alex was back at his previous job. We shared this with the Verizon Risk team.
Woohoo!
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we actually were talking at that point about could we integrate this with Verisk, because it allows us to slice compromises in slightly different ways than Verisk does. And I had looked at Verisk pretty closely and determined that Verisk's compromises didn't line up with the sort of analysis I needed to have in my data. And so I created a new thing. And so actually, I really wanted to suggest that the thing we could do is organizations that are doing incident response in various forms, or people, CIRA members, Risk Hose podcast listeners like yourselves, could take a look at this and possibly use it to understand not the individual compromises, but to put their compromises in buckets to understand how they're happening at a higher level way.
And the whole purpose is simply to create and strengthen that feedback loop, right?
Precisely.
So, I mean, the whole thing that we were talking about back in episode 12, around 39th minute in there, we were talking about the feedback process, how it's missing. So when people go and they try to think, what projects are we going to do this year? And they're trying to prioritize these projects, having something like this in place in your organization already is going to give you material on which to try and figure out what to prioritize for the next year. What projects should we roll out?
Exactly. And let me give you an example of one of those feedback loops. People in information security have known that malware and bad guys take advantage of the auto-run feature in Windows. And we've known that for a while, but we've had trouble quantifying it. One of the things that we were able to do using this taxonomy was to actually quantify what was involved, how many machines might be getting compromised because of auto-run, and to use that to drive that patch into the Windows Update channel, where previously it was a download that you could get. Now it's a download that you will get if you set your Windows machine up with the recommended settings. And so that's a feedback loop that we actually went through using this, but it's not the only feedback loop that you could go through.
So, I mean, looking at your report, you have in there, you're like 26% of the malware detected in the first half of 2011 had leverage sort of that auto run, at least the USB feature, and then 17.2% leverage the auto run on the network feature of mounting a drive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the type of stuff, that's the type of feedback that you're seeing that you can then use that to gauge the next step and the next decision that you're going to make, which is to push that into the next update or whatever round that would be, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the other big chunk that you can see here to actually look at the data and talk about it is user interaction required. And the particular team that I'm on is doing a lot of work on how do we improve when the user has to make a decision, how do we help them make the best decision that they can make by making more clear user interfaces, by suppressing questions that might habituate them to, oh, this is that dialogue again, I just click OK because I need to get my work done.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to see this really helps us as we go out and talk to people, both internally and externally, understand that helping people make better decisions is really going to pay off for security professionals. We'll have fewer incidents if we do that better.
Yeah. Now, what's really interesting, there's a graph, figure 4, in the document that we'll link to. You know, if we picked sort of a random security person and said, which is more important to focus on, 0 days or things that people click on, the user interaction required category that you have here, Adam. And I think we would probably get a mixture. I don't know what kind of mixture, but I think it would, most people would probably say user interaction, but I bet we'd get quite a few 0 day people saying focus on 0 days, right? But looking at the feedback you have here, you clearly need to focus on the user interaction required as far as the type of malware that you're detecting.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to be really clear on in looking at figure four, this all comes from telemetry from our malicious software removal tool, which goes out to hundreds of millions of machines every month. And it's telemetry. So the data we get back is that the malware is on the machine. We don't get any telemetry on what was the impact of that. So this is a pure frequency graph. It's not a frequency times impact or something else that incorporates impact. And, you know, based on public information, 0 days tend to be used in higher impact sort of situations.
That makes sense. I mean, that's another thing about the feedback loop is that you want to have context for it, right?
Yep, absolutely. But the other thing is you think about, like, the 0 day that was allegedly used for RSA.
Mm-hmm.
They dropped an Excel spreadsheet into someone's spam folder. And the person then dug it out and double-clicked on it.
Mm-hmm.
If the person in question hadn't done that, the fact that there's a 0 day in that spreadsheet is zero impact.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's another piece of mail. It's another 100K on your mail server, but really, those are close to zero impact.
Yeah. So the type of things that are coming out of this, Adam, how do you see this? Do you see this driving specific sets of decisions, or is this more internally from Microsoft? You suggested that people take a look at this and perhaps adopt it in their own organization.
So let's jump to figure eight for a minute.
Okay.
And I think that you could use this in your own organization. You can say, okay, given this compromise that we are investigating, right, and let's say you have some sort of incident response function and enough incidents that you want to measure them to learn things from multiple incidents within your organization. You can go through and say where was the crucial set of failures that occurred, or you could use a system like Veris to classify things in conjunction with this, and then say, you know, what's really happening here, and we'll go back to your story of configuring the ACLs to control user access to data.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a configuration issue. How many configuration issues are you spending your time on over the course of a year? And if you're spending a lot of time in configuration controls, do those configuration controls line up with the loss events that you're experiencing?
Yeah.
And you can do this within your own organization, but I think even more, and I think that's interesting. I think that people may get value out of it. And I would love to hear from people who are doing that, whether they're having challenges or success, because I think of this as a living sort of thing that will learn things. And if you look down at figure nine, the custom software section really comes from Alex and Wade and also Chris Porter, I believe, was in the room, where the known or discovered by an attacker was something that they saw in doing their incident response work. And we've extended this because one of the things we'd like to do is make it possible for organizations to talk to each other about what they're experiencing. So if Jay is doing this in his organization and Chris is doing it and Alex is doing it, then we can have a conversation between us where we don't have to get into the, I can't tell you the details of this, because the details have been hidden away by the act of classification. And so Alex might say, you know, I have 25 incidents of this type. And Jay might say, well, I've got no incidents of that type, but a lot of incidents of this type. And from there, you can say, well, you know, we invest a lot in this control, and we don't have any incidents like that. Are you investing in a control like this? Yeah. And that gets us to the point where our feedback loops are not just within our own organization, but we might think about constructing feedback loops between organizations.
Yep, and I think that's going to be a critical point moving forward is that, you know, when we try to judge success and failure in information security, I mean, the one clear statement of failure from a security perspective is a breach, right? I mean, that you can label that as less than successful. And so those are the types of events that we want to dig in and try to understand and see what caused those, what is creating those. And then if we can do that on a broad scale, we can start to leverage sort of, you know, economies of scale, law of large numbers, that type of thing. So sharing it, I think, is going to be a critical component moving forward so that we can get sort of these broad numbers that we can start to really make sense of.
I think for me, the problem with that is going to be that management structures, because I wholeheartedly believe that where there is an operator, there is a room for measurement and understanding as well. In other words, it's one thing to automate a defense. It's another thing to have look at the incident as a whole and have the operator involved, whether that is an end user that's been compromised, whether that is the administrator of the web server who was or was not doing their job, so on and so forth. And for me, the problem with that is there's a whole other layer of understanding that I think we would want to acquire. That's why I'm so, you know, I've got such a rush for the Gene Kim stuff, because this, you know, he kind of went there and did that for, you know, kind of specific use cases in visible ops for IT security. But if we can start to do that, then we're starting to really decompose aspects of the system where we care about them. We can't decompose the entire system. We can't even hope to decompose bits of the system where we have even the most influence, but we can decompose at the incident level and understand what our practices were. And I think that would be significant, because that would beat what we're currently doing, which is list a bunch of controls. If there's not a control missing, go out and focus on that. So the current audit IT security and IT risk and whatever audit models are, hey, we want to see these 30 controls, right? So you go in, you know, and you do your audit, you show them 28 or 29 controls, you're missing 1 to 3, and somebody gets a burr in their saddle that you need, you know, this other control. And so what does your group do? They go and focus on these other controls. Why? Because you need the audit thing to go away. Meanwhile, what's going on with those other 29 controls? Because now you've myopically focused on this other one. We don't understand the impacts of variance within operations. So I think a lot of this is great, but I would love to see it taken to the next step and say, okay, let's try and describe the operating environment to some degree. And I don't know how to do that.
So actually, Alex, I think that's a really interesting point that you're bringing up, is that we can think about this not only in terms of controls, but in terms of audits, and organizations have these.
Well, I don't even like to say audit.
Go ahead. Let me try and derive a little bit of value out of all of that work that's being done outside of our control.
Right. Okay. Go for it.
Okay. So let's say you and Jay both get audited by, you know, the Acme audit company, right? And Jay gets a report that says he's missing these 5 controls, and you get a report that says you're missing these 5 controls. And then you look back at your last 6 months of incidents and you say, gosh, you know, those controls actually had nothing to do with the incidents that we had. What we really need to do is we need to strengthen these controls that are present in a way that make the auditor happy. But, you know, the other person says, wow, no, these missing controls really did line up. Mm-hmm. We can start to think about feedback loops for the audit process and for the compliance lists themselves.
And that, I think, is probably the holy grail, right? I mean, to start to standardize the set of, I don't know, things that people are audited against. Right, I mean, right now we have a set of controls that are largely based on people sitting around a conference room table saying, this seems like it'd be smart, you know. And so I think having this type of feedback loop and driving the changes and even waiting, you know, some of these controls that we're auditing against would be just a fantastic way to place to get.
To dream the impossible dream.
Yep.
Yeah, good times.
Chris, did you have a question?
I think we lost Chris.
No, he's on.
I'm here. There's like pop-up screens going all over my screen, so I apologize.
Were you surfing porn?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
Dude, it's 4:35 Eastern. Come on. All right.
I don't see the relevance of that.
So you talked about auditing and compliance, but so here's a question we have coming in from Twitter, from @Spancer. When are there positive feedback loops in InfoSec?
When are there positive feedback loops?
That was the question, Jay. Yes.
As opposed to negative feedback loops?
I mean, I think you might be saying useful feedback loops rather than positive or negative in the engineering sense.
Or could it be talking about feedback on basically failed hacking attempts?
Yeah. Let's go with that one.
Yeah. I think what we're saying, I mean, overall, what I think what you're saying, Adam, and what my article was about is that we're missing feedback, you know? So, I mean, to say when are we getting positive feedback, I think the simple answer is we're not getting nearly enough if we're getting any at all. You know, so, I mean, we may see, you know, dropped packets on the firewall. We may see the IPS system firing on some things, but I don't know if anybody's looking at it. I don't know if we're learning from those in any way at all.
We are, but I can't talk about it.
That's such a cop-out.
That is. So let me ask a question to both Jay and Adam, since you guys are sort of spearheading this conversation. Is how does this fit into risk management proper?
Ah, very good. Well, do you probably didn't ask me for my opinion, but I'll give
it to
you.
Well, I didn't because you're not allowed to talk about anything, but if you can respond to it, Alex, go for it.
Are you talking about positive or feedback loops or what we just discussed?
No. How does this concept of feedback factor into risk management proper?
Oh, well, that for me, that one's pretty easy, right? Well, if you take a second, rewind the tape here, and that was my rewind noise for those who don't realize
nice.
Thanks. But if you take this, rewind it, and think about it in terms of my personal holy grail, which is coming up with some sort of repeatable skill for control efficiency, control effectiveness, whatever you want to call, well, that's where I see a lot of this going, right? The feedback loops we want are to understand sort of that negative space that is opposite the the big amounts of change in the threat landscape, right? So we know the threat landscape changes. We know it changes with some degree of rapidity. We don't have a precise number for that, but we can watch it. We can watch, you know, rates of change and new stuff and vulnerabilities and exploits and so forth, right? What we don't have is like, okay, rapidity of change. As it is effective to those corresponding threats out of our controls. We just know it sucks, right? Because we know it takes vendors so long to come up with something different. We know, you know, it takes us a while to get some signatures. We know that our signatures suck to some degree, but we don't know to what degree they are in any particular install, so on and so forth. So that's the first place that I read this should be going. From a risk standpoint. And then you obviously know, Chris, that now that my folks are learning FAIR and stuff, where I would love to go with that, right? Because now I would actually have something on that resistance, that vulnerability side of the equation that would be really useful and easy for me.
I think it would be pretty hot if you could incorporate feedback loops into the project funding cycle. So, you know, towards the end of the year, after people have actually spent money to mitigate all this risk that they're going to reduce, which half of it I would assert is probably unvalidated to begin with, you know, was it a good investment on behalf of the company? Can that project team actually offer up some proof as to the risk mitigation that was done by investing $100,000 or $1 million, whatever that number might be, of the company's money to reducing risk or to under the flag of compliance. We will now be in compliance with statute or regulatory statute X, Y, or Z if you give us this money. That's what I think of feedback loops.
Can I geek out on a side topic that you made me think of for a second?
No.
No.
No, please. Like geek out. Like,
no,
it's the Risco's podcast.
I'm not,
what more geekiness do you need? Do it.
I'm not gonna go there. But to answer your question though, Chris.
You gotta do it now. No.
All right, okay. Side topic. All right, sorry. So Chris, you mentioned, what, you guys need some time there or something?
Side topic.
All right. Chris, you had mentioned though about being able to come back and get feedback on projects year after year, right?
Dude, it's your sidetrack. Go for it.
Well, I've been trying to answer that, trying to research that. And what I found, it's something actually that Alex introduced me to at our Secure 360 talk, this process called GQM, Goal Question Metric. And what the purpose of this is exactly that feedback loop. And this was developed in the 70s initially. And it's been gone over and gone over, improved and improved. And the whole point is that before you do a project, you establish a goal for the project. And so the goal might be improve the timeliness of change management requests. And so you've got the improvement, the timeliness is the quality, and the object is change management. You can sort of divide these goals up into different attributes, and then you propose questions around it. Well, if we want to improve the timeliness, what is the timeliness now? Where do we expect it to be? And you set all of these goals and questions to come back and measure how it's going and how it's doing. So you can make statements about, we expect to be here, and when we come back in a year, we're going to come back and measure this exact thing, and here's how we're going to do it. So you're essentially building in that feedback loop when you're establishing these projects in the first place. And so the framework is called GQM, Goal Question Metric, and it's out there if people want to Google it. All right. Okay. Back to regular scheduled podcast.
Yeah. So if I can try and talk for a minute about what Chris was asking about, which is, did this spending help? Right? Was this $1 million invested well? The reason that's difficult, the thing that makes that really tough is, okay, so you spent $1 million. You're not going to spin up two versions of the project, one with that $1 million and one without it, just to do a scientific experiment of, was this $1 million well spent? And, okay, Alex will, because he works for a bank.
Well, I guess, why would you have to conduct an experiment? I mean, hear me out here. If I have a, let's just say, 100 issues in my risk repository related to some macro level risk type. Let's say it's access control, specifically password strength, okay, for access control. Why would you have to experiment? If this particular investment would mitigate completely or reduce significantly the risk associated with access control around passwords, why would you have to conduct an experiment?
Well, I'm going to be a heretic. I'm here on the Risk Hose podcast, and for the purpose of spinning you all up, I'm going to say that risk doesn't matter to the business. What matters to the business? Let me finish before you get too spun up. What matters to the business is the outcome. It's what happens. It's, did that risk turn into a loss? And risk is an attempt to help sort that question out before those things happen. And in that, it does matter. But what we want to do is say, okay, so I mitigated those risks at this cost. That's a good thing or a bad thing. And if my risk universe consists only of this problem, only of this single project, then what you get is hard to evaluate. But if what you're doing is you're making a new app for a phone that allows you to do, let's say you're a bank again, you're doing checking, you take a little picture of the check and you send it in and it deposits it. And let's say you've got five banks who've made different investments in risk management along the way. Which one has the lowest rates of fraud per 100,000 customers, or per $1 million of deposit, or you know, whatever the agreeable comparative metric between organizations might be, which one got the most value for the money spent on security? And I think that's why the ability to compare outcomes and the ability to say, does this spend, hits the ability to say, did this spending help?
I agree with you. That is not heretical. I actually tend to agree with you in principle on what you just said. So sorry, there's not going to be any jumping up and down and Chris cursing or anything else. I agree with you.
Hey, Chris.
Burn him anyway.
No, wait. Chris, though, he did say risk management doesn't matter to the business.
No, that part I don't necessarily disagree with, but I agree with the spirit of what he just said. I think that risk management proper is going to help prioritize how the organization spends money, but the business cares about results. So he was spot on with that statement. You either deliver or you don't. And I would contend that there's a lot within information security and information risk management proper. In most companies, there's not strong enough feedback mechanisms to actually validate that the project teams did what they said that they were going to do, let alone actually reduce risk.
And I think this is a really important point that it's hard for us in information security to see, because we know all of these really good reasons that it's hard to construct these feedback loops. But when you go to an executive team and say, I want to spend $1 million on X, and they say, well, how much good does it really do? And we don't have great answers to those questions. It leads to a lot of the pain that leads people to say things like, well, the CSO has to report directly to the CEO so they can have influence, so that they can get what they need done. I'm going to suggest that really good feedback loops that allow us to quantify investment, allow us to quantify losses, not even quantify the magnitude of those losses, but just starting to quantify, these investments seem to actually reduce these losses, is more effective than getting a direct reporting line to the CEO in terms of getting what you want in securing your business.
Amen. If that's a defensible number, you don't need a direct. You don't need a direct line. You don't need a salesman CSO. You don't need a call of personality.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be heretical here. You guys have to disagree at some point.
Hey, no, Adam, you're wrong.
Sometimes common sense isn't too heretical, at least on this podcast. Now, maybe in information security proper, maybe that sounds heretical, but not in my book. Rock on.
I mean, if we break it down, risk management is really all about supporting the decision process anyway, right? So, I mean, whether, you know, Chris, what was the original question? It was like, what does the feedback have to do with risk management or something like that?
Yeah, primarily because this is a risk-related podcast.
Well, no, I think it's all intertwined, because the risk management is a form of a feedback loop, right? So if we go in and we do analysis of some system or process or service, and we say, here's how much exposure there is to loss, we can use that. Actually, if we make another feedback loop around that, we can start to improve the risk analysis process itself. But that feedback saying, here's where we think this system is part of a feedback loop. You guys built this system. We're going to go out and measure to the best of our ability our exposure to loss with this system. That's a form of feedback. So I think feedback is such a, I don't know, foundational concept in any sort of learning that we're talking about. And let's face it, we have a lot of learning to do, that I think we need to focus on the feedback in every process that we're doing.
Well, I don't think that risk management is a feedback loop in and of itself. I mean, a risk management process or framework is exactly that. It's a framework of which feedback needs to be a part of that framework or that overarching risk management process. So, I mean, high level, if you have a risk management framework that consists of governance, planning, execute, analyzing, and both of those, you know, are somewhat circular in nature, where you constantly have this loop between that analysis and that governance and planning portion is going to be feedback. And probably feedback actually spans through all four of those components. But Yeah, I understand what you're saying. It needs feedback needs to be built into a risk management framework.
Well, let me call it something I put out in my article, and that is that in order to learn from an environment, you need feedback, right? The feedback, it has to be timely, accurate, and understandable, right? You have to be able to absorb it. So looking at that, the things you just mentioned, Chris, I mean, what we're trying to produce there is feedback that's precise and timely, right? And somewhat palatable, so that when we convey this to decision makers, that they can understand it and make a decision based on this information.
I agree with you, Jay. Well said.
This has been such a wonderful conversation, but it's also been horrifically depressing.
Why?
Why?
I think it's beautifully. I think it's inspiring. I feel better. I feel like I could go out and conquer the world.
And globally, there are thousands of risk Dubuques. We're not allowed to call it Risk Detroit because apparently we've offended folks in Detroit. There are thousands of risk Dubuques out there who are all doing, you know, their risk function at best is RCSA processes with high, medium, and lows that are basic SOX reporting.
Oh, let me qualify. The risk analysis I was referring to is like the 1%. And for the record,
risk 1%. You just went there.
I did.
Congratulations. Yeah. That's it. We're not calling him Risk Utopia anymore. Chris is officially the risk 1%.
Adam, real quick, we actually have a question for you from at Selena Kyle. And here's the question.
Allie. Hi, Allie.
That's a pseudonym. You're not supposed to tell anyone her real name.
Right. That's why I gave the Twitter handle. Okay. So here's the question.
Nice going, Alex.
When is Adam's next card game coming out?
When is my next card game coming out? Let me sidestep the question and comment on a game that I was given this Wednesday by Dave Birch. Dave is a leader at Consult Hyperion in the UK, and he's been working with some folks at an organization called Vome. And they've come up with a game called Privacy, and he gave me a copy of that, and it looks really cool. So I think to answer Selena Kyle's question, Privacy is the next cool security-related game coming out, and I can dig out some links and make sure they're in the show notes.
So you don't have a new card game?
I do not have a new card game that I am ready to announce.
All right. I didn't want you to fully sidestep the question.
Damn you, journalist.
I don't think he did. He answered it appropriately.
Yeah.
I'm looking through the Twitter feed to see if we have any other actionable questions, not just insults towards Alex Hutton.
Actually, I want to go back to something dumb that Alex said.
Shoot.
Nice.
No, it wasn't dumb. It was on the where most people in risk analysis are versus this risk utopia that I'm talking about and that Jay is talking about with our feedback loop stuff. And actually, it wasn't. What Alex said was spot on. Most people are way far from this. But I think that a lot of people are also frustrated being far from this. And to the extent that you're frustrated and that there is a way forward, let's experiment. Let's work with these ideas. Let's see, you know, I've got one approach. I think Verus is another approach. Can we use these to increase interorganizational feedback loops? Can we use these to increase feedback loops to the compliance programs themselves? And it's going to take time. It's going to take effort. If someone is coming in and they're doing a 9-to-5 job and they're doing what they're told because that's what the boss wants to see and they're not going to try and make it any better, it's a legitimate choice that they're making, but there's a lot of people out there, and I think the folks who contribute their time and energy to CIRA are examples of the folks who want to make their jobs better, who want to get more done. And hopefully these feedback loops and tools like this taxonomy can help them along that way.
And so I strongly encourage people to go out and follow the link in the show notes and read Adam's report, take a look at this framework, provide feedback, implement it where you can, talk about it. I think promoting any sort of feedback loop at this point is going to be helpful.
So, Adam, you stated that the Varus just wasn't robust enough or wasn't good enough for what it is you're trying to do there at your employer. So is there any potential integration or feedback that you're giving to Verizon to actually integrate these two approaches or to make their approach better or what have you? How would you respond to that?
I think all taxonomies exist for some purpose, that we classify the endpoints because we want to do something with them, or we classify the questions. And, you know, this happens even with something as nature-derived as like the Linnaean taxonomy of life. It used to be morphological based on animal shapes, then it went to DNA, and now there's arguments about should it be DNA or mitochondrial DNA. The issues that I had with Varus were that when I classified things using Varus, they didn't give me the sort of actionability that I needed. And so, you know, it's obvious. You look at the doc we published, where we've been talking to the Varus team. What's going to come of that? Who knows? Do we need multiple things? In the long run, probably not. In the long run, it will probably help everyone to converge. When will we get there? We'll get there when we get there.
But these don't seem contradictory. You know, it seems like you could have both of them, because I think what your framework is doing is that it's looking at a specific element in much more detail than Varus does, for example. I don't see them as contradictory.
I don't either, but, you know, right now we have no one from the Varus team at Verizon on the phone. So really, I think it would be premature to comment on where that's all going to go.
Yep.
So, listeners, we actually had a fuller lineup for you today, but we've already... I don't know,
Alex,
where to start. Yeah.
Alex, why do you think that this conversation was depressing, though? No, I mean, we talked about the feedback loop, and I mean, like, are you depressed that the feedback loop is non-existent, that the loops just aren't there, or what?
Right. So, you know, I've said that this was depressing, and in a sense, it's not depressing because the content is bad or that the content is unattainable. It's just depressing in that I have seen, risk organizations that are far from this. I've seen the frustration from, you know, CFO level folks. I've seen the frustration from risk management folks who are caught in the middle, who want to do a great job. And for whatever reason, there is this bureaucracy between them and the actual decision owner. excuse me. But in all seriousness, as much as that is depressing, at least there's hope. At least you've got a handful of people and the people listening, all you good listeners out there, who can say, yeah, you know what? Current state really sucks. And current state is a lot of waste. So, you know, it's something that we could do better. And maybe you could join the Sierra mailing list. And maybe, you know, if you aren't already, and maybe if you are on, we could start talking about how you're changing things in your organization and the challenges that you're facing. But, so you have, to put it in car talk terms, you've wasted another perfectly good hour of your life listening to the Risk Coast podcast. Again, I'm Alex Hutton. Thank you for listening. And Jay, thank you. Jay Jacobs, everybody. Woo! Jay,
hey, thank you, Alex. Thank you.
Chris Hayes and his magic coffee cup.
Hey! Yeah, whatever. Hey, Adam, thanks so much for being on tonight. This was sweet.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks.
Our very special guest, Adam. Thank you, guys, and good night. I feel like we need a transition, though. Like,
how about? Oh man, that was good stuff. How about we move on to?
Thank you. seriously, suck it for saying that.
Sounds like a Twisted Sister moment, Jay.
It does.
We're not gonna take it. No!
This is Adam Shostak, and I just blew the promo reel for this Risk Host podcast.